On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American-born Mideast scholar Rashid Khalidi comes from one of Jerusalem's most prominent Palestinian families, a family of historians. Like millions of Americans, he looks out on the unending Israeli-Palestinian conflict with anguish and dismay. Now, Khalidi has picked up the tools of his trade, history, to ask why the Palestinians have ended up without an independent state of their own. History is a minefield in the Middle East, a battleground itself. This is Palestinian history, tough on a people's adversaries and tough on Palestinians, a search in the past for clues to the future. Up next on Point, Rashid Khalidi rereads and rethinks Palestinian history. Joining me now from New York is Rashid Khalidi. He is professor of Arab Studies and director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University, and he's author of a new Palestinian history called The Iron Cage, the story of the Palestinian struggle for statehood. Rashid Khalidi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
Why another, a new history of the Palestinians?
Well, this is not a full history of the Palestinians. It's a history of what I thought was a really important story that hadn't been told, which is the story of why the Palestinians failed in their quest to develop structures of state and to become an independent people. It really is, in my view, necessary because I don't think that this story has been told looking at the Palestinians as having a narrative worth recounting in its own right. And I think that's what I tried to do in this book.
Help us understand your perspective and background as you look into this history. Give us a little sense of your own family and personal history, your family's place in Jerusalem, your journey to America, sort of where you sit today as you engaged in this scholarship.
Well, my journey to America began when I was born in New York City. So,
I should say families, not your own.
The
but it is a rich history here.
Mm-hmm. My family originates. My father's family originates in Jerusalem. Many people in the family have been scholars and have played different roles in that city's history. My dad came to the United States as a graduate student, actually on the last ship to cross the Atlantic before World War II began in September of 1939. Mm-hmm. The Queen Mary, I think it was, and went to Michigan. Ended up in New York doing war service in the Office of War Information. And after the war, was planning to go back to Palestine, but because of the events there, he couldn't. In the interim, he married my mother, and he had me and a couple of other sons, and worked for the United Nations. So I come from a family that has ancient roots in Jerusalem, but I was born and mm-hmm. brought up in the United States, although my father's work took us all over the world, to Korea, to Libya, to mm-hmm. Lebanon, and so on.
And with those ancient Palestinian roots in Jerusalem, can you share what was your sense of Palestinian history, the kind of big story? Now that you've gone deep into Palestinian history with this book, do you find a big gap? Is there something in the kind of... Every country has a national mythology that rides with and in and alongside its history. Did you find what you sort of grew up learning at your family's knee and beyond jibe well with what you find as an historian here or not?
Well, a lot of what I call the nationalist myths, which every nationalism has, exist in the Palestinian case, and I think I address some of them in this book. What I found was... Let me start with where I started from, in the sense that I picked up on this history to some extent in two ways, both from reading and listening to people talk, but also from listening in particular to what my father was doing in the Security Council. He worked for the Secretariat of the United Nations, and his job was in political and Security Council affairs dealing with the Middle East, which was about half of the work that the Security Council did from the time he joined the UN. Until his death in 1968. And so at the dinner table, I was listening to Security Council resolution whatever being discussed mm-hmm. or what had happened on the Sea of Galilee that day and so forth. So that part of the history I was watching unfold before my eyes in the 50s and the 60s. And the other, I was listening to it but in a different way or reading about it in a different way. And I think it, to some extent the book reflects both of those perspectives. My own reading as a historian, as someone who's steeped in this, of some of these received versions of history, and my understanding of things that I've actually seen myself. So there are parts of the book that, I mean, I was in the chamber of the Security Council when the ceasefire resolution was adopted in June 1967. I was actually sitting there watching Lord Carradine and Arthur Goldberg and so forth in the visitors gallery. So some of it, and I was in Beirut during the siege of 1982. I mean, so I, on the one hand, I'm a detached observer who has a connection to the events, and a historian, and on the other, I'm a sort of observer who was there for the events themselves.
Right. In the title, you've got the Palestinian struggle for statehood. Of course, that's a statehood that the Palestinians, an independent statehood that they do not have, as we speak in 2006. And in your history, there's also kind of there's a search woven through there for why. We should take us back as a historian to some sort of key points in Palestinian history. Where do you go back to begin understanding how the Palestinians have ended up in the position they're in today? And it's certainly further back than 1948 in your telling.
Absolutely. This is essentially a 20th century conflict, 20th and 21st century conflict. It does not go back to time immemorial. And where I choose to start is essentially with the British Mandate. I mean, I talk a little bit about the Ottoman era and its impact on things, but I think I dealt adequately with that in an earlier book, Palestinian Identity. Mm-hmm. What I do in this book is to try and explain the answer to the question you just mentioned, why did the Palestinians not get a state, starting with what I describe as the iron cage imposed on the British by imposed on the Palestinians by the British during the Mandate, which is where I begin the book, and the first couple of chapters are set from the early 20s until 1948. And then I try and explain how some of the same problems, both externally imposed and internally generated within Palestinian society, prevented the Palestinians from succeeding in that same quest in the period from 1948 until the present.
You look at external factors also internal. You say it might be asked why I describe this failure to achieve independent statehood as a Palestinian failure.
Right.
But the iron cage, let's start there. You describe that as a British imposition. What do you mean by it? Where does the language come from?
Well, it was just my – it's not Max Weber for those social scientists out, social scientists out there.
Okay.
And it's not, you know, Jabotinsky's famous phrase, the iron wall. It was my reaction to my understanding as I wrote the book of the structure that the British created to prevent the Palestinians from achieving statehood, to prevent the Palestinians from achieving self-determination, to keep them away from any of the levers of political power in the mandatory state. Remember, the mandate system was supposed to set provisionally independent states, nations, on the road to independence. And in every other mandate, it eventually did, except in the case of Palestine, where, of course, the State of Israel did result, but the Palestinians were prevented and failed, prevented from and failed to achieve statehood. And so the iron cage is a metaphor that came to my mind as I looked at the incredible restrictions that the British used to ring around the Palestinians and prevent them from achieving their objectives, starting with the terms of the mandate itself. The League of Nations mandate for Palestine doesn't mention the word Arab or Palestinian. The Palestinians, as a collective, don't exist there. They are Christians and Muslims who have civil and religious rights. They do not have national rights. They do not have a national existence. They do not have political rights. And the British are pretty much faithful to this approach of seeing the Jews in Palestine as a national entity entitled to a national home, which Britain is obliged to encourage and develop, and the Arabs as just a group of Muslims and Christians whose civil and religious rights have to be protected, but in who, in fact, by the terms of the mandate, almost have to be kept away from state power. So the overwhelming majority of the population of Palestine at the time the mandate is adopted, which is 90% or so, is kept away from what the League of Nations mandate system is supposed to achieve, which is self-determination and independence. And this is one of the ways in which one of the elements of this iron cage that the British construct.
So there's the British factor at that period. But then, of course, comes 1948. You describe very dramatically the crumbling of Palestinian society, the lack of the minimal resistance to a process of dispossession, as you describe it, 750,000 people fleeing their homes in a few months.
Right.
And you do not pin all that on external factors on the British. What's the Palestinian responsibility or historical root behind that collapse?
Well, what I try and argue in this book is that the collapse of 1947-48, mainly the spring of 1948, has to be traced back to earlier events and earlier decisions, events in the late 30s in particular, or the early 30s, and decisions taken by the Palestinians and by others. I focus on mainly Palestinian decisions, which meant that really it was a done deal long before the collapse occurred. The Palestinians pretty much ceased to be a factor from 1936-39 onwards. That's the last time in which they are a dynamic actor. And I try and examine why that is the case, what decisions were made, why they were made, what other decisions might have been open. And one of the things I try and argue in this book is that the Palestinians have to be seen as having agency. They have to be seen, even though they were within this iron cage in the Mandate period, for example, they have to be seen as having had choices. They may not have been all good choices. In fact, most of the time they were all bad choices. But there is a difference between bad, worse, and worst, or between fair to poor and lousy. And so I try and examine some of those choices. Obviously, this is not a book which is full of counterfactuals. I don't, you know, put together a fantasy history that could have happened. But I simply try and examine the degree to which the Palestinians have to be seen as having had agency for good, for bad, or otherwise.
Shalom is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Shalom. You're on the air with Rashid Khalidi.
Hello, Professor Khalidi.
Hi.
I am glad you're starting from the beginning of British Mandate because, as you know, the British appointed the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who organized the riots against Jews and British and what was British Palestine, and later collaborated with Hitler in murder of Jews. Yugoslavia got his promise to kill the Jews of living in Palestine if Hitler's Nazi armies conquer Israel, what was then Palestine. And is that included? And also the fact that he was, after the war, greatly admired by the various Arab countries and was supposed to be the first president if there was a Palestine.
Shalom, let us pick it up. Rashid Khalidi, the Grand Mufti. You write about him at some length. How do you respond to Shalom's question?
Well, I do write about the Mufti at great length. I'm writing this history to address this question of state, and so what I mainly address is the Mufti's failings. Insofar as he ended up, in my view, playing a major role in the diversion of the Palestinians from a focus on taking over the mandatory state apparatus or creating an alternate structure of their own. Insofar as the Mufti was appointed by Sir Herbert Samuel at the very beginning of the mandate, because Sir Herbert Samuel felt that he would help the British to keep order. Mm. And so with all respect to your caller, in fact, up until 1936, far from organizing or fomenting riots, the Mufti was one of the best allies of the British in keeping control of the situation on the Palestinian side. Your caller, of course, is right. After the 36-39 revolt, during the entire period of which Haj Amin tried to maintain his links to the British, he thereafter ended up in Germany and did, as the caller says, collaborate with Hitler. I talk about that, but it's not my primary focus, because what I'm trying to look at is why the Palestinians failed to achieve structures of state. So I talk in great detail, for example, about the Mufti and his colleagues' attitude to the 1939 White Paper and his rejection of it, even though a majority of his colleagues in the Arab Higher Committee were apparently in favor of accepting it. I also talk at the end about how the Mufti and his leadership were completely discredited after the 1948 war. So again, I disagree with your caller. He was not greatly admired, neither by Palestinians nor in the rest of the Arab world after World War II, and in particular after the 1948 war in Palestine. The exact contrary is the case. He pretty much disappears from Palestinian history, as does the entire class and generation of leadership that he represents. They're completely swept away as a result of their failures, in part. So the only part I agree upon with your caller is that indeed the Mufti did collaborate with the Nazis. There's no question about that.
You're very tough on Palestinian leadership in many segments of this book, certainly up to and including Yasser Arafat. Is there a consistent thread in the failings of Palestinian leadership that you would point to, or is it sort of, you know, each leader with his own challenges and own failings?
I mean, some things are the same and some things are quite different. One common thread I see is a failure to understand certain aspects of the way in which Zionism and Israel relate to the great power of the day, whether it was Britain in the Mandate period or whether it's been the United States since World War II. I don't think either the Palestinian leadership before 48 or the very different Palestinian leadership after 1948 had a full and complete appreciation of that whole extremely important issue. And I talk in more detail, I think, in discussing Arafat and that generation of leadership than I do about the earlier generation.
But how could that be missed? I mean, Britain was an empire, world-straddling in its day, the U.S. in its own way later. How could any Palestinian miss that dynamic?
Well, this generation and this people from this class, many of them did. Not everybody did. I have a whole chapter about people who disagreed thoroughly with their own leadership, probably a majority of the population. I mean, the 36-39 uprising, which involves a six-month general strike from April to October of 1936 and is followed by a nationwide upheaval in which a huge proportion of the entire adult male population of Palestine is either killed, wounded, or imprisoned, is a rising from below against the Palestinian leadership as much as it's against the British. And obviously it's directed against the Zionists as well. But I think this is very important. I think these people in many respects missed it because they came out of a tradition that they were old-fashioned notables, to use a term pioneered by Albert Hourani, who saw themselves as intermediaries between the Ottomans and the local population and thought that they could play the same role between the British. They were completely mistaken. And the interesting thing, which not enough historians I think appreciate, is the degree to which there was disagreement with this in the press from various sectors of Palestinian society throughout the Mandate period.
So you see a mishandling, a misunderstanding of relations with or power of the kind of superpowers of the day. What about over the time that you're looking at here, the Palestinian or the Palestinian leadership's understanding of the Israel project and how their comprehension of it is factored in to the history you're writing?
I mean, the Palestinians see Zionism, certainly for the Mandate period, as a colonial project being carried out at their expense. What they cannot see is that at the same time this is a national movement in the building. What they understand perfectly well that Jews are being driven out of Europe by Nazi persecution. What they don't understand is, or what they have difficulty coming to terms with, is that this involves a force supported as it is not just by the British but by the League of Nations, which they're going to have to figure out some way to deal with. And I it's not fair to say nobody understood this. Mm-hmm. Many people understood aspects of it. But the degree to which this is a new development, is I think not fully appreciated. There's a sense in which Palestinians insisted on seeing the Jews, perhaps as a people, but not as a national entity. Judaism is a religion. But if somebody had come back and said to the Arabs, well, you're just Muslims and Christians, you're not a people, they would have objected to that. And so I think there's a sort of failure of imagination there. And I think it hurt the Palestinians in the end. I'm not sure that even if they had said, okay, we understand that the Jewish people are developing into a national entity, they would have said, therefore, take our country. Because that is really to some extent what it boiled down to. What we now know, what's pretty clear, is that the Zionist movement was not just looking for a cultural home in Palestine. The intent was to create a state at the expense of, in the place of, the Palestinians. And I'm not sure how that could have been better reconciled. But certainly if they'd understood this and accepted some aspects of it, I think the Palestinians might have been better off. But in any case, I simply point out that this is the way these things were seen.
Are you arguing in the book that the Zionist project might have been successfully resisted or that a clearer comprehension of it might have given the Palestinians a better chance at coexistence in statehood?
Well, I don't argue for changing history. This is not a counterfactual history. What I do point out is that there is a fundamental shift in the fortunes of the Zionist movement in the early 30s. Up to that point, the Jewish population as a proportion of the whole was declining for 5 years from 18.7% to 17.3%. With the rise to power of Hitler, the Jewish population becomes over 30% in a matter of a few years. Everything changes after 1933. Things that might have been possible, whether compromise or resistance, before 1933 become increasingly less possible after. I'm simply pointing that out. I'm not saying they should have done this, they shouldn't have done that. I'm simply pointing out an important watershed in Palestinian history, which you have to understand even though these things are taking place in Eastern Europe.
Let me take a call, if I may, Professor Khalidi, from Revere, Massachusetts. Carrie is online. Hi, Carrie, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am so glad to hear this topic raised because over the years, as I've heard Palestinians interviewed, the theme song is always, it's all Israel's fault. And if you are casting yourself as a victim, that means that you have no power, which means you also have no responsibility. And it's all kind of on the victimizer's plate to make your situation better. And to me, that seemed like a real dead end. So I'm really glad to hear that this book has been written and that the Palestinians are being addressed as people who might have bad options but who do have choices.
Carrie, thanks for that. Rashid Khalidi, how do you respond to that interpretation of what you're up to here?
Well, I mean, I think you know, without having read the book, Carrie's understood something that I'm trying to do in it. I don't think I let the Zionist movement or Israel or Britain or the United States off terribly easily.
No, you're tough at many points on both sides.
I'm harshly critical of almost every policy adopted by our government since 1948, and I'm pretty hard on the British. And I don't think I cut the Zionist movement or Israel an awful lot of slack. But as the caller said, as Carrie said, however bad the choices that the Palestinians may have had, to see them simply as victims is to deny them agency and to deny that they had choices. And I point out periods when they did have choices for greater resistance, for a different approach to the British, for this, for that, in the 90s, in the 20s. And, you know, this is not a blame game. I'm not sitting here saying, you know, this or that Palestinian leader or leadership should carry this opprobrium for the eternity of time. I'm simply trying to cast this in a different light. Probably the greatest historian of the Jewish people of the last century, Salo Baron, who taught here at Columbia, once decried what he called the lachrymose view of Jewish history, which he felt denied the Jewish people agency in their own narrative. And I refer to that, referring to Jewish history, not to Palestinian history. But I think that getting away from this sense of the Palestinians as helpless victims can only be a good thing, which is, of course, not to deny that they almost always in their history face absolutely overwhelming odds.
Mm. Rashid Khalidi, I want to invite an Israeli historian into this conversation, if I may, for a moment. Joining us today from Linz, Austria, is Tom Segev. He's a columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, one of a group of Israeli scholars known collectively as the New Historians, author of 1967, A History of the Six-Day War, due out soon in the U.S., Elvis in Jerusalem, and profoundly, One Palestine Complete, Jews and Arabs Under the British Mandate. Tom Segev, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello.
So here you
hear...
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Okay.
Here you are both on opposite sides of a kind of background, in a way, looking at the history of your own people. Tom Segev, you famously seen as a kind of revisionist, the new historian on the Israeli, of the Israel story. Here's Rashid Khalidi. Doesn't describe himself as a revisionist, but striding into Palestinian...
He doesn't have to. Others will.
what do you see in the project of Rashid Khalidi? You must look at it sympathetically, given the work you've done as an Israeli historian.
Well, my experience is that it's terribly important to, from time to time, re-examine national mythology. We in Israel, for many years, did not have real history. We had mythology, we had ideology, we had a lot of indoctrination. Now, Rashid Khalidi is doing that at a very delicate time for the Palestinians, because the Palestinians are still in the process of nation building, and they have not yet attained independence, and they are still struggling. So I think that it is much more interesting to do than the way I did it at a time when Israel was strong and victorious and mature enough to re-examine its own history. So I really think that it's a very commendable project, what Rashid Khalidi is doing. And I think it may be more interesting than to read American reviews. It will be interesting to read Palestinian reviews. I wonder if for Palestinians, Rashid Khalidi is a real Palestinian historian. I'm not sure, but, you know, it'll be interesting to see how they relate to an American Palestinian taking up Palestinian history.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Rashid Khalidi, how about it? At this point, what's the response you're getting from Palestinian readers? Are they looking at you as one of their own, telling their history, as a revisionist who's blowing away important national mythology? What's the response?
You know, I'm getting interesting responses, starting with members of my own family and friends who've actually looked at parts of the manuscript, and continuing mm-hmm. through the audiences I've been speaking to in the last couple of weeks as I've been talking about this book. In some cases, I'm getting anguished responses, and I'm sure I'm going to get critical responses. There's no question that some people are going to cling with every fiber of their being to some of the myths that I critique here and some of the approaches that I critique here.
Is there a myth that you perceive people most not wanting to surrender in the response you've heard?
Let me just say one other thing, which is that everybody knows that most of what I say is true on the Palestinian side. Anybody who has ever said anything about Yasser Arafat or has ever thought about the Mufti knows perfectly well that every single thing I'm saying is absolutely true. The only issue will be to reference what Tom Segev just said, is this the right time to talk about these things in front of strangers? Do we wash our dirty linen in public? As to what the most the thing that causes people the most anguish, I think it's probably letting go of this sense of being a victim. I don't know. I mean, it's early days. I'm not entirely sure. Different people have disagreed with different things that I've written. We'll see.
Tom Segev, what's your sense as an Israeli historian who's broken new ground, looked at things afresh, questioned national mythologies? Do you see the possibility of a path to mutual understanding between Israelis and Palestinians in the reconsideration of history, in the more cool, calm, factual presentation of history?
You mean a common narrative, Israeli-Palestinian?
If not a common narrative, then does the, does it lead toward, are these two ends of a bridge that lead toward something that might meet when historians become cool and serious?
I don't really believe in a common narrative, but I think it's terribly important for societies to have an accurate and critical view and understanding of their past. And I know how important it was for Israel when we started to do that many years ago. You still mention us as new historians, but the new historians are elderly gentlemen by now. But and there are other new historians, of course. But it's really terribly important to get away from mythology, because as long as you hold on to your own mythology and ideology, you're not likely to learn from your mistakes, and you're not likely to consider alternatives. So the only way really to do things differently is to get a real view of what happened in the past.
Nasser is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Nasser. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Very well. What do you think, Nasser?
Well, just looking at everyday events throughout the world, and in particular the Palestinian issue, since the establishment of the Israeli state, I don't believe Palestinian state, it was ever meant for it to happen, and it will never happen, bottom line. Regardless to the choices that the Palestinian people has or had, whether being poor or being worse, a Palestinian state is something that we will never see on the map.
Nasser, let us put it to Rashid Khalidi. Looking at the history first, Professor Khalidi, Nasser says he looks back and it was never going to happen.
It certainly was something that the British did not intend to have happen. And, of course, it didn't happen until 1948. Before 1948, even though the United Nations General Assembly, the partition plan of November 1947, called for the creation of an Arab state in Palestine. And we know the reasons it didn't happen. The Palestinians were weak, but they were conspired against by Jordan, by Britain, and, of course, by Israel. As to whether it will happen in the future, only God knows. Allahu a'lam, as we would say. But what I point out at the end of the book is that the possibility of a two-state solution, of a Palestinian state alongside Israel, whether it's a good or bad or an indifferent idea, is increasingly unlikely if the current dynamic, the dynamic that in my view has been ongoing for almost going on 40 years, continues. It's simply not going to happen. There are powerful forces, powerful dynamic forces not just settlement, not just land seizure, not just the expansion of the mechanism of control, changes in American policy and so forth, which will make it impossible to create such a state. So I don't pronounce myself on the future. When I'm giving talks and I'm asked difficult questions about the future, I sometimes say the job description of a historian doesn't include predicting the future. So I'm not predicting the future. I'm just saying if present trends continue into the future, your caller is right. There will not be a possibility of such a state.
And I can imagine Nasser, our caller in Nashville, thinking, Rashid Khalidi, where are you pointing for hope in this history? He looks back and says, you know, what were we supposed to do? Up against all this, are there moments in that history, Professor Khalidi, where you would look and say, my dear fellow Palestinians, look at this. If in this circumstance we had found some other response in ourselves, or if our leaders had done X, Y, or Z, we might be on a different path now?
I mean, there are points where I argue that the decisions that were made were not the best ones. I talk about the 1991, 92, 93 period, where I was myself involved as an advisor to the Palestinian delegation. And I simply repeat what the delegation itself said, what the head of the delegation, Dr. Haider Abdeshefi, said to the PLO leadership in Tunis. If you go on this way, it's not going to work because the United States has promised to stop. But it didn't promise to stop. It said that actions which prejudice or prejudge the outcomes of negotiation were not acceptable. If the United States is not prepared to do something about that and stop settlement expansion and the closure of Jerusalem, the separation of Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank, then one side is eating the pie that we're supposed to be negotiating the division of, and this will lead to a catastrophe. The PLO leadership, in its lack of wisdom, in my view, ignored those warnings, had us continue to negotiate, and then went off at Oslo and did a deal that was worse than anything I think the delegation in Washington from 91 to 93 would ever have accepted. So, yeah, I point out places where I think extremely poor decisions were made.
Jerry's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering if Rashid has any thoughts about why the Palestinians didn't develop a peaceful or passive resistance strategy which worked with other nationalisms, particularly India, and one that I think would have been extremely effective with the Israelis.
I actually do talk both about the 30s and the way in which the Indian example had enormous appeal among Palestinians. One of my students, who's about to publish a book on this, about the Istiqlal Party, which was arguing for boycott, nonviolent resistance, and so on in the late 20s, early 30s. I do talk about that. And I was very struck. I saw the play My Name is Rachel Corrie the other night here in New York, preview. And one of the things that Rachel Corrie, the woman who was killed by an Israeli bulldozer in Rafah a couple of years ago, one of the things that she said in her emails, which are the basis of this play, is that, you know, people talk about Palestinian violence. What they don't realize is that in the face of the overwhelming violence which sustains the – she says it more eloquently than I do, of course. In the face of the unbelievable, overwhelming, constant daily violence that sustains the occupation, the great majority of Palestinians are passively resisting, simply – and not acting violently – simply by going on and living, and I think that's something that's ignored. Having said that, I and many other people have been arguing that, in fact, given the current constellation of forces, an approach like that, a much more systematic approach like that, might be a good one. I noticed in an AM newspaper recently published in Ramallah, a leading Palestinian political scientist, Ali Jarbawi, argues for that, and I heard those calls as well. It's a very difficult thing, given the overwhelming violence of the occupation, but it's not something that's actually been ignored, whether in the 30s or in the present.
Let me take one more call from Cambridge. Betty is on the line. Hi, Betty. You're on the air.
Hi. I think it's important for people to realize that the Palestinians could have had a state of their own at least four times without firing a single shot, without a single terrorist attack, without a single war. They could have had a state of their own 1947-48 when the UN offered them a state and they refused. Could have had a state any time between 1948 and 1967 when Arab states, not Israel, occupied the West Bank and Gaza, no state. They could have had a state after the 1967 war when the Israelis offered land for peace and the Arabs and Palestinians said no negotiations with Israel, no peace for Israel. Could have had a state year 2000, the Clinton-Barak plan, but instead of even offering a counteroffer, the Palestinians responded with an intifada.
Betty, our time is short. Let me put it straight to Rashid Khalidi. Rashid?
Well, each of the points that she raises, that Betty raises, deserves an ample response, and I don't think we have the time for it. Let me just talk about 47-48. 1947, 1948, the three most powerful actors on the ground there, Britain, Israel, and Jordan, were all committed and dedicated to preventing the creation of a Palestinian state, and they did so. So the Palestinians might have been able to have a state had they been much stronger and had the Jordanian, British, and Jordanian-Israeli agreements, secret agreements at that time, not meant that the three most powerful actors were going to make sure that that baby was strangled in its cradle. So they could have, they might have, but they didn't. And the reason that they didn't had only partly to do with the Palestinians themselves. I don't know how much time we have, but
not enough to pick up each of those.
Each of these requires quite a detailed response, and there's something to what she says, but there's a lot to be said in each case.
Let me put the same question too that I put to Tom Segev, who remains with us from Linz, Austria. There, in this Palestinian historical narrative, and looking at it with, let's say, Segev's and other Israeli historians, Benny Morris and others on the other side. Is there a place where these can reach out to one another as sides of a bridge and meet, or do these national narratives pass each other by even when new historians come to them, Rashid?
I agree with Tom. I don't think you can have a shared narrative. We're talking about the same facts, but they fit within the context of two different narratives. What I do think is really important, however, is to understand that to really understand Palestinian history in its own specificity, on its own, in its own right, you have to understand modern Jewish history, the history of Zionism, some Eastern European history, and the history of the great powers. You are an ignoramus. You know nothing about Palestinian history if you don't know all of these things. And by know them, I mean really know them. Understand what the rise of power to Hitler meant. Understand what the Biltmore Declaration of 1942, when Ben-Gurion shifted Zionism from dependence on Britain to dependence on the United States. These are crucial elements in another narrative, but they with not failing to understand them means you won't even understand your own narrative. And this is an implied critique, just last thing. Mm-hmm. This is an implied critique of some of my close friends who are among the Israeli revisionist historians. I think they've brilliantly revised some of their own national myths. But what Israelis have to do, as Palestinians have to do, is to incorporate into their own narratives things that come from a completely different place, because you won't understand Israeli history unless you understand Palestinian history. I would argue, just as you can't understand Palestinian history without understanding the things I mentioned.
Tom Segev, our time is very short. A parting word to a fellow historian who's stepping out into new history here?
I absolutely agree that one of the reasons why the Palestinians failed to attain independence so far is their inability to understand the inner meaning of Zionism, and I also definitely agree that in order for Israelis to understand Israel, to understand themselves, they absolutely have to know more and understand more about Palestinian history.
Tom Segev, author of The New History 1967, coming out soon in the U.S., thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Rashid Khalidi, author of the new book The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood. Professor Khalidi, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.